him on what I think is a very important topic. And I was charged with actually providing mostly the background on this. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to talk some about the rationale for rescreening, which I think can be summarized as saying that recurrent infections are common, morbid, and important at a population level. Talk some about published intervention studies and trials, a little bit about what we've done in Seattle King County in terms of trying to operationalize this, and then finally a few comments about future directions. So this slide is a little complicated. It's showing you observed and modeled rates of recurrent chlamydial positivity in women over 36 months from a very nice study published last year by the California State Department of Health STD program. I think I would concentrate on the dark bar, which is looking at the observational studies with active follow-up. And what you see overall is that at about 3 months, there's an 8.5% risk of infection and a 15% risk at approximately 6 months. So very common. The data on gonorrhea recurrence in women is a lot thinner. This is summarizing the studies I know that had cohort studies with active follow-up. Dennis Fortenberry, who I just saw walked in, looked at this in almost 500 women, only about a 2% prevalence of infection at 1 month in that group. But among the subset that they were able to follow for a longer period of time, you were looking at a 24% prevalence by 3 to 4 months follow-up. So even if you said that none of the people who didn't follow up were infected, you would still end up having probably an infection rate in the neighborhood of 10%. We looked at this in a randomized control trial of expedited partner therapy, and in the control arm of that study, we had a 13% risk of gonococcal reinfection or infection in 3 to 4 months. Tom Peterman looked at this in a much smaller group within Project Respect, seeing about a 4% risk, but only 39 people in that study, so pretty small numbers. Again, the data from men are not as robust as what we have in terms of chlamydial infection in women. But if you look at the two core studies I know of, Patty Kissinger looked at this in her urethritis study of expedited partner therapy. Again, relatively low follow-up, but 33% of the men had recurrent gonorrhea at 1 month. So even if you said that none of the people who completed the follow-up, who didn't complete the follow-up, got reinfected, you'd still have a 10% risk of reinfection at 1 month. In our study, we looked at people 3 to 4 months. We had a 13% risk of reinfection at 3 to 4 months. For gonorrhea, the largest study actually was done by Cleveland. It was never published, but they saw a 7% risk of infection at 1 month. Patty's study, again, this urethritis study from New Orleans, 15% risk of gonorrhea reinfection at 1 month. In our study, we saw 9% risk of recurrent gonorrhea in men at 1 month. Tom Peterman, 15% within Project Respect. So I know these, I just went through a huge number of numbers really quickly, but to try to summarize it, these just come from our study of expedited partner therapy in the control arm. The one upside to this is we were able to look at both men and women, gonorrhea and chlamydial infection. The pattern's pretty clear. I mean, we're talking about a 9 to 13% risk of recurrent infection at 3 to 4 months in men and women for gonorrhea and chlamydial infection. So nothing predicts the STDs like having had one. There's really the only population in the state of Washington that would have a similarly high rate of infection would be girls in juvenile detention, who have a 12% risk of chlamydial infection where I live. There is no other screen population which has this much infection. Now, why is this? Well, I think for the chlamydia, part of it is treatment failure. So these data come from our randomized trial again, looking just at people who said, I never had sex again between the time of my initial therapy and when you rescreened me at 3 to 4 months. So among those women with gonorrhea, only one of 38 who said they never had sex were reinfected. Among the women with chlamydia, 22 of 287, 7.6%, were infected when we retested them at 3 to 4 months. No men were persistently infected. So I suppose it's possible that the patients were lying to us. But you would have to hypothesize that women with chlamydia lie, but women with gonorrhea don't lie and men don't lie. And see this? I mentioned this to my wife, who said that's impossible. Men are definitely lying. So, I'm not going to comment on that. I think she's a sexist, it's clear. But it does seem implausible to me that the lying would be restricted to one gender with one infection. Moreover, the data are pretty consistent. So if you look at Will Whittington's cohort study of chlamydial infection, Among those women who said they didn't have sex in between 1 and 3 months, 7% were persistently infected. In Julie Schillinger's randomized controlled trial, which had a similar design, women were tested at 1 and then again at 3 to 4 months. 12% were persistently infected if they did not have sex in the interim between their treatment and their retesting. So I think pretty consistent pattern. Will Geisler and Peter Kernt are looking at this in incarcerated women, which is, you know, a population where they feel they can be more confident that they are not having sex following their initial therapy. So we'll see what that study shows. I think that will be interesting. So again, these recurrent infection is common. It's also morbid. This slide is showing you data from what I think is probably the best study of pelvic inflammatory disease ever done, probably the best one that will ever be done. It was done in Lund, Sweden. They enrolled over 1,200 women with laparoscopically proven pelvic inflammatory disease and almost 450 controls, followed them 90 months with 90% follow-up. You know, we're lucky we get 60, 70% follow-up at 3 months. They're getting 90% follow-up at, you know, 5, 6 years. So it's really extraordinary. And what they saw is among those women with no pelvic inflammatory disease, their risk of ectopic pregnancy or tubal factor infertility was 1%. With a single episode of PID, that rate went to 7 to 8%. And then with the successive episodes of pelvic inflammatory disease, each one, it roughly doubled the risk of major morbidity. And it's that cycle of recurrent infection, and in particular, really, recurrent pelvic inflammatory disease that we're trying to avert with our control programs in an effort to decrease the overall morbidity associated with these infections. So the last bit of this is that I think, you know, probably people with recurrent infections are important in sustaining the epidemic. And this is really this idea of a core group. I think it's probably more germane to gonorrhea than chlamydia. These, again, are old data from 1978 from Indianapolis. But what they were seeing at that time was that 7% of people with gonorrhea had 22% of the infections. And that if you looked at those people who were coming in, for in a prospective study, were you likely to get reinfected? If you had had gonorrhea multiple times, your reinfection risk was 22%. If you had had it one time, it was 5%, and if none, 4%. So again, people with STDs get STDs. Nothing predicts your risk of getting an STD like having had one. That's actually true of epidemiology in general. People with heart attacks get heart attacks. People with cancer get cancer. People who try to kill themselves try to kill themselves. You know, everything works that way. So the rationale is the risk of recurrent gonorrhea and chlamydia is high in both men and women. Gonorrhea is now relatively uncommon in the United States, making screening relatively ineffective. The prevalence of family planning clinics is less than 1%. Where I live, it's not even 0.5%. Morbidity in women is associated with the cycle of recurrent pelvic inflammatory disease, and people with recurrent infections probably play a disproportionate role in ongoing transmission. But the idea of concentrating on rescreening is not a new idea. It's more than 30 years old. So, you know, and it failed. So we really have to think about, you know, what has been done in the past, what happened. So these data come from Denver, a study looking at what do different interventions buy you conducted in the 1970s. They enrolled over 400 people, and the objective was to do test of cure, screening at 6 weeks, screening at 12 weeks. So everybody gets this reminder call when they were first treated. 8% came in for their test of cure with that, 14% at 6 weeks, 8% at 12 weeks. They then called them, and the reminder call had a big impact, as you can see, on test of cure. Moves it from 8% to 60%. Very modest effect on the 6 and 12 week screening, but you do wonder maybe the patient's had enough, right? They sort of felt like, you know, my test of cure was negative, I'm done with you. Adding a letter to the reminder call had a very modest effect. And then they sent the DIS out on them. That really didn't buy them much either, actually. So what they concluded was the telephone calls made sense and the other stuff didn't make much sense. Now, this was studied much more rigorously by Kevin Malotti and others in the GCAP study. This involved actually two randomized controlled trials, and since Kevin is here, he can correct me if I get it wrong. But the population was comprised of STD clinic patients in Prince George's County, Maryland, and Los Angeles. And they were randomized in the first part to one of three interventions. So a recommendation to return with an appointment card and $20 if you came back, or a motivational interviewing intervention with reminders, initially a call, and if the call was unsuccessful, a letter. And the outcome was returning to the clinic for retesting within 3 months. And this is showing you the results of that. So the motivational interviewing and the reminder call or letter was effective. It increased overall retesting rates roughly 10%, so from 13 or so percent to 23%. Now, in the second part of the study, they then tried to disentangle these two intervention effects. So people were randomized to receive, again, one, sort of a recommendation and an appointment card, that plus a phone reminder, or that plus the motivational interviewing intervention. And the thing that made the difference was the phone reminder. So they got up to about a third of the people came back. Tom Giff then did a cost-effectiveness analysis of this study, and he estimated that the reminder calls cost roughly $13.50 per person. Now, to my estimate, that means that a single full-time equivalent can successfully contact 4,500 people a year. In my experience in partner notification research, I don't believe that's realistic. I think 1,500 would be a productive person. So I think that they're lowballing this. But even if they do, the cost per infection treated comes out at $224. We usually spend closer to $900 per screen case identified. So even if you said it was a lowball estimate on the cost, which I think it is, probably it's still, you know, in the range of what we spend to find a case. There are some limitations. This was an STD clinic-based study. STD clinics are only diagnosing 15 to 20% of these infections. And just because it's cost-effective doesn't mean you can afford it, right? So a lot of things are cost-effective. We don't buy them. Perhaps we could shift some of the resources into an activity like this. So I don't want to poo-poo that because I think that is plausible. But I think it will be a challenge. The better option is, can we shift the cost to diagnosing providers? So public health is kind of the opposite of life. In life, it's good to be generous. You should buy the other guy a beer or a cup of coffee. In public health, spend the other guy's money, right? So we're trying to, you know, really, we have very little money. You want to husband it very tightly and try to get other people to use their resources. There's also been studies of male rescreening in women. These data were generously provided to me by Fujizu, because this study was not yet published, but it has been presented. It enrolled 877 women from STD clinics in New Orleans, Jackson, Mississippi, and St. Louis, and the intervention was rescreening kits mailed at 3 months plus reminder calls, or just a reminder call to return to the clinic for rescreening. And what you can see is the home rescreening group did have a higher rate of retesting, but the intervention had a pretty modest effect. We're talking about, you know, about a 6% absolute increase in rescreening rates. Again, still getting in the neighborhood of about a third of the people retested. So what can you say? Well, I'd say unaided, relatively few patients present for rescreening just because they're advised to do so. A telephone follow-up probably works. It's supported by data from Denver in the 70s and more recently from rigorously done randomized controlled trials. It's also consistent with the reminder recall data from the vaccine literature, which has looked at this really a lot more. In our experience, we did a randomized controlled trial, which I didn't show you. If you really badger them, you can actually get it over 50%, because I had a medical student do that. But, you know, that's very resource intensive. I think the telephone reminders are probably cost effective, but whether programs can really afford them or not, I'm not sure. I think retesting through the mail results in a small increase in retesting when it's coupled with telephone reminders. So again, that was a very intense intervention. So now I'm going to shift a little bit to some things we've done in King County, which are really programmatic activities and not randomized controlled trials. So we have an electronic registry of all the cases that we use for purposes of partner notification. And then starting in 2001, our health department made a decision that we were going to recommend rescreening everybody with gonorrhea or chlamydia infection within 3 months, so men and women. So we did this several years before CDC came up with their recommendation, because the data really have existed a long time. And if you diagnose someone with gonorrhea or chlamydia in Seattle, you get a letter from me at 3 months, which said, 3 months ago you diagnosed Ms. Jones with chlamydial infection. It has now been 3 months since that diagnosis. Public Health Care King County recommends that you retest her at this time. You can retest her with urine, right? And when we first initiated this program, before we contacted a random sample of the providers of 100 cases, and we did the same thing 6 months after institution of the program, and you can see this study is showing very disappointing results, the proportion retested within 30 days and more than 12 weeks. No movement. You know, accomplished big zero, big stinkaroo. And at this point, I have to confess, I try to be a database kind of person. I still send out the letters. Because I give a lot of talks in the community and things, and we get responses about the letters. So we are going to try to do a more rigorous evaluation on this. It's very easy for us to do this. It's all automated. Once a month, we spit out hundreds of letters and someone stuffs them in an envelope. So it's a very cheap intervention. So I think even if it were modestly effective, it probably would be worthwhile. We also have tried to incorporate mail rescreening into our standard partner application activities. So in the past, we actually aren't doing this right now, but in the past what we had done is when we first contacted you, we said, well, can I send you a letter, can I send you a rescreening kit, or you have the right to refuse these things. 13% of people wanted a letter, 27% rescreen kit, 60% said, no, I don't want you sending stuff to me. So of those people who accepted the kit, 35% returned them. They did have a relatively, a decent prevalence of gonorrhea and chlamydial infection. The problem with it is it's a pretty marginal intervention. So if you say the total proportion of the population I managed to rescreen equals the proportion of cases receiving partner services for gonorrhea and chlamydia, which was 40% at that time, times the proportion accepting this kit, which was 27%, times the proportion who returned the kit, which was 39%. It's 4% of the population was affected by this intervention. So, pretty small numbers, not a screaming success. So in summary, I'd say people with recent histories of gonorrhea and chlamydia are at high risk for recurrent infection, and that the rationale for rescreening all of these people is strong. That reminder calls to patients can somewhat increase this relative in rescreening, but it's resource intensive and appears to still get you to the 30-some percent range, not to the 70-80% range. But the issue is really a general one in STD in our business. It's not just about STDs. The whole basis of our ability to control HIV is increasingly going to be focused on finding the cases quickly and getting them into therapy. And for MSM, which represent 57% of all the cases of HIV in the United States, what we want to do is we want to test them a lot. So we need to get them back to retest. In King County, high-risk MSM, we recommend every 3 months. So the problem of getting people retested, how do I get you back, is the same problem for HIV testing as it is for chlamydial rescreening. And it's the same problem for vaccines, for HPV vaccine. So Lori presented the data on HPV vaccine, Lori Markowitz, looking at national immunization surveys suggesting 30% coverage. That was 30% coverage, one dose, right? That falls off dramatically. So how do you get the kids back? It's the same problem as the retesting problem. So this is a general problem and is ripe for cross sort of a general, Kevin Fenn's been talking about integration. This is an integration to be funded project. So where now? Well, what's the characteristic of the desirable program? Well, first I think we need a population perspective. Optimally, from our perspective, it would be linked to surveillance, but I recognize that's tough. It may be hard for health departments to directly contact people without their consent. The alternative is to go through the providers, and I think that certainly is worth trying to do to change the provider behavior. We want a low-cost approach. Probably this can't entail calling tons of people at public expense, but I'm open to people's thoughts about that. So the issue is, will lower intensity reminders work? Emails, text messages, things that can be automated in the same way these letters we send out, which we just spit out once a month from a computer file. Those, I think, are more promising. Should we be focusing on those people with the highest prevalence infection or who suffer the greatest morbidity or are most important in transmission? What would those populations be? I'm not entirely sure. It might be reasonable to focus in particular on gonorrhea in women, since I think that's associated with the greatest morbidity. Younger people for chlamydial infection, I think it's clear reinfection rates are highest in the young. I think some consideration of focusing all of our interventions more on African Americans is worthwhile. I mean, what really has been our progress in ameliorating the glaring and horrific disparities in STD that are observed across all our STDs? I would say we haven't made a lot of progress. So we need to be open to the prospect of intensifying our interventions with the express purpose of decreasing disparities. So this is my last slide, and I probably hit my limit anyhow.